As we reach out to touch you, Lord, touch us with your word of life. Amen. What makes a good story? The building blocks are the words we use every day, but ordered in such a way that we are drawn into the world they create. One of the oldest techniques is to embed a story, one story, inside another. You begin your tale, interrupt it with another one, you finish the first one, perhaps to create suspense or to stop your listeners getting bored too quickly. You'll find plenty of examples in the Bible, and we have one of them today. In fact, it's even more complex. It's layer upon layer. Jesus calls Matthew, a tax collector, for the hated Roman government. We move on to a dinner full of people like him, whom the opponents of Jesus regard as little better than scum. They ask his followers, not him, mind you, why he eats with people like that. When Jesus hears this, he remarks that you don't need a doctor if you're well, only if you aren't. But it's a pointed rebuke. Who exactly is ill and who isn't? Is it the people who are despised by the righteous? Or is it the righteous who imagine that they are pleasing God by their religious observances? By directing them to a text from the prophet Hosea, in which God gives priority to mercy over rituals intended to please him, Jesus is implying that the people who need a doctor like him may be those who think they don't. Then the followers of John the Baptist begin to question him directly. Why don't you and your disciples fast like we do? Again, his answer is meant to provoke thought. His examples, not fasting at a wedding, not mending old cloth with a new piece, not filling old wineskins with new wine, imply that he is bringing something new to the world of religion, which doesn't fit the assumptions people have grown up with. And in the middle of all that, the president of the local synagogue appears out of the blue, begging Jesus to lay his hands on his sick daughter and restore her to life. As Jesus makes his way to the house, a woman suffering for many years from menstrual bleeding suddenly touches his cloak, hoping to be healed. And Jesus tells her that her faith has made her whole. On he goes, and finds the mourners already making a commotion, is ridiculed for telling them that the girl is not dead but sleeping, takes the girl by the hand, and she recovers. I make that five separate encounters in the space of 17 verses. It's like one of those days at work, okay, I'm retired, but I do remember, when it's one thing after another, and there isn't a moment to draw breath, except perhaps to snatch a bite at lunchtime. Matthew's account of a few hours in the life of Jesus looks like a hodgepodge, not a carefully constructed narrative. All these different people, these snatches of conversation, is there anything that holds them together? Especially the two healing stories. For reasons best known to himself, Matthew leaves out some of the details provided by Mark, that the woman has spent all her money on doctors who had only made things worse, that she had heard about Jesus, and that when she touches his cloak, he feels the power go out of him. In the other story, Mark and Luke name the synagogue leader as Jairus, and both have Jesus utter the Aramaic words, Talitha cum, meaning little girl, get up. Mark tells us that the girl is 12, while Luke adds a human touch as Jesus tells the mourners to get her something to eat. Step back a moment from the breathless account Matthew gives, and you'll begin to see some common elements. There's constant movement. Matthew follows Jesus. The synagogue leader comes to Jesus. The woman comes up behind Jesus. Jesus goes to the leader's house. Both the leader and the woman are introduced by the little Greek word idu, look, behold, see. And then there's touch. The synagogue leader asks Jesus to lay his hand on his daughter. The woman touches the hem of Jesus' cloak. And then Jesus takes the hand of the little girl and she gets up. There are relationships, positive and negative. The Pharisees are critical of the way Jesus and his followers behave. And so are the disciples of John the Baptist, not pious enough, not serious enough. But the heart of it all are these two people who turn to Jesus desperate in a time of need. The contrast between them is integral to the story and is fascinating. He obviously is a man, well-known local dignitary, who knows what it means to occupy a position of responsibility and is no doubt used to getting things done. She is a woman, but worse than that, her condition makes her ritually unclean. If Mark is right, she has been unwell for as long as the little girl has been alive, 12 years. Both desperate, but while he is confident in approaching Jesus, she is the polar opposite, doing her best not to be noticed, knowing that her condition makes everything and everyone that is in contact with her unclean too. You can read all about it in Leviticus 15. If a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her impurity, which means her menstruation, for all the days of the discharge, she shall continue in uncleanness, and so on. So the poor woman has been in this unclean state for 12 years, presumably since puberty, which puts her in her mid-20s. It means that she is excluded from some important aspects of community life, but worse still, most probably, from marriage and a family of her own. These are ancient taboos, not exclusive to Judaism. Indeed, in medieval Christianity, menstruation was regarded by some as Eve's curse, a punishment for the fall. For hundreds of years, it was regarded as unclean and may still lie behind the opposition to women's ordination in some parts of the church. This woman in the gospel story stands for all those women who have suffered in silence and shame because of a biological function intimately connected with the reproductive cycle. Just to set the record straight, there are laws in the same place which relate to how men become unclean too, but not for 12 years. Now, healing miracles can be problematic for us. Medical knowledge in the ancient world, indeed, until relatively recent times, was much less advanced than it is now, and we are rightly suspicious of miracle cures promised by tele-evangelists, particularly if you send them money. On the other hand, we are more aware of the link between the mind and the body, the physical and the psychological. You'll be familiar with the placebo effect and how belief, perception, and expectation can cause physiological changes and may affect the outcome of an illness. We know too that isolation and loneliness can significantly worsen our overall health, mental and physical. It may be that Jesus is unusually sensitive to the complex relationship between the mind and the body, and to how individuals themselves relate to wider society. In both healing miracles, the central characters are divided in status and gender, but united in need. Human need does not recognize the boundaries of status and power. Tragedy can strike anyone, and leaders of the community and people of faith are not immune from suffering, loss, and grief. Sometimes people at the top of the tree find it hard to seek the help they need, as if the illusion of power they strive so hard to maintain would be shattered were they to be seen to be as vulnerable as anyone else. But the leader of the synagogue isn't like that. In his time of need, he asks for help from someone who has a proven track record. And no sooner has he asked Jesus than Jesus is on the way. There are moments in our own lives when the only thing we can do is turn to Jesus seeking help, trusting that somehow his wisdom and love and his power to heal human hurt will touch us. In this case, Jesus acts in a way his contemporaries would have recognized from their own Hebrew scriptures. In 1 and 2 Kings, the prophets Elijah and Elisha both raise a child from the dead. In Elisha's case, through mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. How Jesus knows without seeing her that the little girl is asleep, not dead, I cannot say. But Matthew is aligning his actions with those of the prophets as the one who brings life where others see death, and pointing to the cross and resurrection where that is most powerfully displayed. There are two elements in the woman's story which I find extraordinary, and they both come when Jesus says to her, "Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you whole." By addressing her as daughter, he is restoring her to the community to which she belongs. Not an unclean outcast, the object of pity and fear, but a full member of the house and family of God. And he attributes the woman's healing not to himself, but to her. "Your faith has made you whole." That's not because she believes he's the Son of God or anything like that. Simply that in her mind, she trusts that he will make a difference to her physical affliction and to all that that implies in terms of how she is excluded from parts of community life. Like her, there may be times when all we can do is stretch out our hand in our pain, hoping to touch him, if only for an instant. As I was preparing this sermon, I came across an article by Jane Townsend of the Home Care Association. Her words rang so true and chime so closely with the stories we've been looking at that I leave you with them. "Many of the strongest influences on health are not things we buy in a bottle or monitor on an app. They are relational, psychological, and social. Feeling safe, valued, connected, and purposeful. Across cultures and centuries, wisdom and traditions have recognized that difficulty, loss, and stress are part of human life. We cannot control every event, but the habits of mind with which we meet those events can shape our well-being. That feels especially relevant in an age obsessed with defeating aging itself. A person can have the wearables, the ice baths, and the perfect biomarkers, yet still be lonely, frightened, and exhausted. It's surely a vital part of any church, inspired by the work of the Spirit among us, to combat loneliness and isolation by building community and sharing in common activities, and to fight inequality and exclusion by insisting that all who come bearing the wounds they cause may find a place of healing and belonging in the household of God. Not everyone has the confidence of a Jairus. Some may only be able to touch the fringes of our life. But let that life always be one in which Christ's healing grace is offered, found, and shared. Amen.